History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Some of these memories just grab you when you try to put yourself in their shoes. When we hear from someone who was a prisoner of war, somebody who was wounded, someone who experienced a close call, or just has a unique way of reshaping our perspective. How about jumping off of a sinking ship blindly while trying to hold your wounded eye in place with a towel? That's something that was happening 80 years ago this week in the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands. The ship was the aircraft carrier USS Hornet, CV-8, the historic carrier that had launched the Doolittle Raid just 6 months earlier, that had then valiantly endured the pivotal Battle of Midway, in which every single plane from Torpedo Squadron 8 aboard the Hornet was lost, with all but one man from that squadron sacrificing his life for our country. On October 26, 1942, in the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands, while planes from the Hornet were damaging enemy carriers, Japanese planes scored hit after hit on the historic ship, which would end up on the bottom of the ocean, never to be seen again until 2019, when the research vessel Petrel discovered the wreckage nearly 2 miles deep. We're going to hear from someone whose locker still holds some keepsakes within that sunken carrier, a man who lost 140 shipmates that day 80 years ago and nearly lost his own life. But first, we're going to hear a few other perspectives that lead us into the Hornet's final moments. You've heard me mention before on this program the USS Hornet Sea Air and Space Museum in Alameda, California. That's a different carrier, CV-12, that inherited the Hornet name after the CV-8 was sunk. But the Hornet Museum is a great place to visit and learn some of the history of the CV-8. As is the USS Midway Museum in San Diego, which has an incredible display on the Battle of Midway. Midway is where Torpedo Squadron 8 met its fate, and St. George Gay was famously the sole survivor of all those who flew off the Hornet that day in that squadron. But here on Hometown Heroes, we heard from another member of Torpedo Squadron 8. Eddie Fail would go on to earn the Navy Cross later in the war. He had witnessed Doolittle's B-25s take off 6 weeks earlier, praying for those Army Air Corps pilots that he'd been playing cards with aboard the Hornet. His prayers would take on another focus in the hospital in Hawaii after he injured himself in a freak accident just before the Hornet left for Midway.
So they put me in the hospital, and the next day the squadron took off and went to the Battle of Midway. A few days later, I'm still in the hospital recovering. George Gay come walking into the room. And of course I had heard about the Battle of Midway that was all over the scuttlebutt. So I said, gee, George, I'm sorry I missed it. And he said, don't be sorry. I'm the only one that's left. That kind of shook me a little.
I could see that.
But as I said before, I think I would have made it back.
How hard was that? Because, you know, we hear that story and we say, boy, all those planes go down. His plane went down. No one knew he survived till he came out of the water after all those hours. But to know that all those men that you had trained with for all that time were not coming back.
That kind of hit hard.
Did that change at all your perspective on the war, the enemy, or what you were doing there?
No, not really. It was just, it's like losing a lot of friends that you, it's more than friends, almost like family. I mean, we've been together for 6 months.
And did Ensign Gay give you an account of what he'd been through?
Yeah.
What he'd witnessed? What do you remember about what he shared and what impact that
had? Well, he was telling me when He went in the water. He was telling me some what he saw, actually. So the skipper, who was flying ahead of him, it looked like if the skipper was trying to get out of his plane. Like, you know, if he was going to bail out, but it was not a question of bailing out. He was flying right off the water, so we don't know what happened.
I don't want to do our listeners a disservice here. I've heard the story of Midway from people that were there, but maybe a lot of the listeners haven't. When you're flying one of these TBDs, can you explain to us what your job would be in a situation like that where there are Japanese ships that you're attacking? How would you attack those ships?
Well, you would try to get ahead of them, for one thing, and try to get a bow shot. 30-degree angle is about ideal. Trying to get close to the water and drop your torpedo close enough to the ship so that not too close, because the torpedo has to arm itself. There's a little prop in front of the thing that uncovers the contact point. So ideally, you're dropping your torpedo 100 feet from the ship.
And how far above the water are you?
20 feet at most.
So you dive down far before you get to the ship. Yeah. You're flying parallel to the water, right, releasing your torpedo, and then hoping that somehow all those guns on those ships don't take you down.
Well, they continue shooting at you.
I mean, I'm sure people listening to that are like, well, that's ridiculous. Of course you're going to get shot down with the speed that those planes were flying. Then not to mention all the aircraft from the enemy, all those Zeros who had more horsepower and could go faster. It really wasn't a fair fight, was it, at Midway?
Well, it's a fair fight. I mean, you take your chances when you're at war. There's no question about it. Well, let's put it this way. I would rather be a fighter.
Mm-hmm. And what does that say about those men who died that day, that they carried out that job, despite what I'm sure they knew were difficult odds?
They were brave men. All the people that fought the war were brave.
Did it take you a while to get over that?
Yes.
Have you gotten over it yet?
Well, I've gotten over it as much as I don't think about it all the time, but when I think of it, it still catches me.
That's what Eddie Fail said in 2015. He passed away 3 years later at the age of 97, and now he is buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Fail was not on the Hornet when it was sunk 80 years ago this week, because after Midway, he was transferred to the USS Saratoga, from whose deck he took off for the mission that earned him the Navy Cross in August of 1942. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as the memories of Al Bloomer, who was not on the Hornet, but on the USS Enterprise in the same task force. He too had witnessed Jimmy Doolittle and those B-25s take off in April. He too had survived Midway. And his perspective helps us feel just how intense the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands was. This was not a battle where ships were firing at each other, but planes from American and Japanese carriers targeted each other's ships. And Al thought the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands 80 years ago this week might be his last. Even though he was using brand new guns as a result of the Enterprise's repairs and upgrades after Midway.
We got repaired, and well, we got those new 40 millimeters. You know, those quad mounts, they could shoot 500 rounds per minute, and they put those on to replace the old 1.1s. We thought, well, it was good, and then we had the all-new 20s. They added some on, put a whole row of them alongside of the flight deck, the side of the superstructure. On the side there, we used to stack up those boats. Okay, we're getting ready, and the old officer in charge of the flight deck said, get all those planes off that flight deck. Get them off. Well, there's someone with an armed refuse. I don't give a damn. Get them off that flight deck. We don't want no aircraft on that flight deck starting fires and that. Pretty soon they get a report, oh, they're 100 miles out coming. And then here again, they go, oh, 75 miles out coming in, getting 50 miles. Then they give us a position. And here I am on this 5-inch, and they're kind of me in the stern. So I'm bringing the old 5-inch gun around like that. And I look up, and here they come right at me. First two releases of the bomb, and they were headed straight for me. And I said, oh, dear old Al, you're not getting out of this one. This is it. There ain't no way that you're going to live through this one. Those two bombs come down, and they just barely missed the splinter shield. They exploded. That raised that old bow up, and shook it, and the water knocked me out. The water came down and brought me back, made me feel shaken. And then what I didn't know, there was two more dive bombers coming behind it. One came down, we went off between the two gun galleys by the number one elevator and exploded down in the third and fourth deck and just cleaned that all out. The next one went out the side of the flight deck outside of the ship and exploded. That was the closest call I had the whole time I was on the Navy. The bow was taking on water down there where the percussion pushed in part of the hull and was leaking, and they were trying to get it under control. But we still launched the aircraft and everything and repeat them, but we couldn't use our number one elevator. We were stacked by 83 aircraft. That lasted 55 minutes, and they launched 10 torpedoes at us, and we dodged them all. That ship could turn on a dime. As big as it was, it could really turn. Let me tell you.
Well, it's a good thing, or else you wouldn't be here, and it sounds like you almost weren't here. First, I'll help us understand, when you're sitting in that trainer position, what's around you? Are you sitting in a chair with your eyes on this scope, or what do you...
They put open sights on them.
Okay.
Yeah, the director can't move fast enough to get dive bombers or anything.
Uh-huh.
It's just open sights deal, and you just shoot the hope the hell that you hit something.
I'm just wondering, so just physically as you're sitting there, what's around you?
Well, the first is a gun here, mm-hmm. and then right there is the sight of it. Right beside you is where it's part of the gun mount.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And the sight setter, he's behind me up here. He stands up and works the sights for the gun on my side. And the pointer is on the other side. He's the one that fires it.
Right.
And they got the loader and the sheller on that side, too, and they load it.
So you're all in this together, and you see these bombs coming, what it feels like is right at you. And then you were actually knocked unconscious?
Well, yeah, I was out there. I didn't know anything until the water hit me. I guess so. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this water splashes all the way up to where you are.
Yeah, it comes down.
Covers you.
Yeah, it going up like that and comes down. The side of the ship comes that kind of out like that, and we just kind of like in a hole there. Yeah, but the gun sits out in the, when they open. This air, also at this same time, it was kind of cloudy that day, too. And this one time, this dive bomber looked over at him, and here he's diving at the South Dakota was on our starboard side. It real close to you. He released his bomb, and I seen him hit the number two turret and explode. It bounced off, exploded, and killed some guys on the bridge in that, on the South Dakota.
Well, and on your ship in that Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands, I believe I read about 44 men were killed.
Oh, yeah.
And then the same battle, the Hornet is sunk, and you guys end up picking up a lot of their survivors, right?
Oh, well, they transferred them. We didn't pick them up. They transferred some of them to us, replaced the ones that got killed on our ship. Yeah.
And another thing I read once about your ship, and I don't know if you saw it or if you heard about it, but because now in the Pacific, you know, the Yorktown was sunk at Midway, now the Hornet is sunk in this battle. The Enterprise is the only carrier left in the Pacific, and I heard someone put a sign on your ship that said, Enterprise versus Japan?
You're right, yeah.
Did you see that?
Yeah, they showed it to us. After the Santa Cruz there, you know, there's a lot of happened there. They detached the battleships from us, and they went down there and doodled it out down there at Guadalcanal there. And of course, they thought that they all conquered, I mean, all destroyed and that. And then they relieved us. We went back to New Caledonia there to a repair ship there, trying to see if they could get the elevator working and patch up some of the holes that they could get reached to. The battleships, they went down there and they had that big duel with the other, and they sunk one battleship down there, and the South Dakota and the Washington was in it too, and then they depatched the ones that the AA cruiser, 5-inch cruiser, that the Sullivan brothers was on down there with them. All they were supposed to be is to protect us because of their thin hull, and that's when they all got killed down there. And so, one of the things, too, that we had brothers on our ship there, and they said, we're going to transfer. And no two brothers can be on the ship at the same time.
After the five Sullivan brothers went down on the Juno?
Yes, that's right.
Well, I've got to ask you, Al, and I know this seems cliche, or maybe it's, you know, an obvious question, but I'm sure it's something that you considered at some point. When you're seeing all this happen around you, you're seeing these other massive carriers sunk, you know, guys off your own ship have died. How about you? Were you concerned that might happen to you? Were you afraid? What was your mindset?
Well, you know, before your battle, you get that kind of a nervous stomach. before because, you know, it can happen to you. But, you know, after you once get started firing and everything, you forget all that stuff. You just do what you got to do and fire your gun and hope the heck that you make it. I don't know how to explain it to be truthful, but you always wonder about it.
A pretty vivid perspective on the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands 80 years ago this week. And we get another from Geb Galley, a Pearl Harbor survivor who was there at the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands aboard the cruiser USS Northampton. Little did he know he would soon be surviving the sinking of that cruiser, the Northampton, but on October 26, 1942, after the Hornet was pounded by Japanese bombs and a kamikaze hit, it was the Northampton that actually took the giant carrier into tow.
He took it into tow, and then, of course, I mean, he had to be approaching her, so we had to cut loose. So he couldn't stay tied to her, so we got out and maneuvered and dodge aerial planes.
So the Hornet is hit at the Battle of Santa Cruz Islands. It's debilitated, so you guys put a line on it. You're towing it, but you make yourselves vulnerable.
We got loose, and then, of course, she went down. We picked up some of the survivors.
What did you personally have to do during that operation?
I could not be on topside. I stayed on below deck. I was in charge of the refrigeration department to make sure that equipment kept running all the time. But I go up on topside every once in a while and see what was going on. When we did our travels after later on, my mother and I, we were traveling. I ran into a guy down in California. He had a bunch of tattoos on his arms. I made a comment. I said, U.S. Navy? He said, yeah. I said, what were you on? He said, the Hornet. Yeah. I said, you took you guys in tow. He said, what were you? I said, Northampton. Well, you're the guys that picked me up. I mean, years later, I ran into guys that were in the same conditions as you were.
So you've seen, I mean, your ship at Pearl Harbor is hit. Now you've seen the Hornet hit. Are you starting to wonder if your ship is going to make it or not?
Question mark.
Who knows, huh?
Yeah, there was, we were towing the Hornet, the Japanese torpedo plane, and it made its run. They came up between us and the Hornet. They were, I would say, from here to the cabinet. I mean, they were that close.
Like 20 feet?
Yeah. I could see the white of their eyes.
Wow.
And they were smiling.
Were you smiling?
Well, I probably gave it a toothpaste smile.
That's why you guys had to cut them loose, because you were too vulnerable.
The period that they dropped, they got the Hornet or not, I don't know. I assume they did. And, of course, we had to cut loose. We could stay tied to the Hornet because we were dead in the water. We were a perfect target because we were dead in the water.
Ultimately, Admiral Bull Halsey would give the order to sink the Hornet, but American forces couldn't quite finish their own ship off, and the Japanese finally did. And when we come back, we're going to hear from one of the last guys from that crew of 2,200 to escape the Hornet, one of the last survivors from that fateful day 80 years ago. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.com. And you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking 80 years now since the famous aircraft carrier USS Hornet met its fiery fate in the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands. Bob Cole was a 19-year-old from the tiny town of Odo, Iowa, where today's population is 72. Back then, it was about 300.
When I went aboard there, we had 3,000 people, 3,000 sailors. Mm-hmm. And that was a culture shock, coming from 300 people to 3,000 people. And seeing this great big ship, the only thing I've ever seen was a little boat going down a river. And so we didn't have any airplanes, you know, because all the airplanes were, when they did get on there, were propeller-driven and not jets. And we didn't have any guns when war broke out, and so we hadn't even been commissioned yet.
Well, that begs the question, what do you remember about when the war did break out? Where were you on December 7th, 1941, and how'd you hear about it?
I was in Norfolk, Virginia, on board the aircraft carrier, and we heard it from our captain over the loudspeaker. Then afterwards, you know, the news flashes all over, so we heard it from the radios also. From there, we went, got all our stuff in a hurry, and they shipped us to, went through the Panama Canal and went to the West Coast in Alameda, and that's where we picked up Doolittle and his airplanes.
Yeah, this is pretty historic stuff, but I'm curious what it felt like to you as a young man, because here you are, I guess you would have been 19 years old when Pearl Harbor happened. You're away from home. You're on this aircraft carrier, and all of a sudden now there's a war going on. What did that do to you emotionally, mentally? How did you process that?
First thing we did, we all gathered around and prayed in our own department and hoped for the best of us. And to me, I never experienced anything like this before. I never, you know, I read about World War One, and but I never visualized we're going to be in a war. And I thought this is going to be 4 years of like the Navy says, come and join the Navy and see the world. And I didn't get to see the world very much.
Not all the parts you wanted to see anyway. And give us a sense of what your duties on the ship were.
I was a storekeeper, and what we did was did the payroll for the sailors on board. We also operated the, what they call a concession stand, where the crew could come in and buy candy or ice cream. Cigarettes. By the way, cigarettes were 3 cents a pack. It was no taxes. I didn't smoke, so that was my duties as payroll and running, helping run the concession stand for the crew.
It probably made you a pretty popular guy on that ship.
Oh yeah. Because we weren't open very often. You know, maybe 4 or 5 hours a day, and different people would run it. I enjoyed every bit of it.
So you mentioned going through the Panama Canal and then around to the West Coast. And you picked up Doolittle and his pilots. Now, this was just unheard of at the time. Everything they were doing was crazy. The deck was not designed to have B-25s fly off it. They had to modify the B-25s to get them to take off in such a short distance. But I'm curious what you guys, as a crew of that ship, knew about this whole thing. What did you see happening, and what were you starting to figure out?
Well, at first, we didn't know we were going to go to Japan. We just knew that they told we have a mission. They're not going to say anything because they didn't want anybody to know what we're doing. And so all we knew is we were taking them to some place. And after we left the United States, we found out where we were going. We weren't too excited about that. You know, going to war, are we going to last my 4 years or what? And what if I get sunk?
Those questions would be answered eventually. Was there a buzz on this ship about these 16 airplanes and these pilots and crews that were aboard?
Very much so, especially when we got to Alameda and they found out what we were going to do. Like you say, number one, how are they going to fly off this thing? Because there's no jets or anything like that. And so it was a buzz. I mean, it was really talked about, hoping that whatever mission we're on, that it would be a good one.
And I think pretty much everyone in every theater of the war had their mail censored. But were you guys given specific instructions not to say anything about this development?
That's right. We told everything. Don't you write back home or anything like that. Don't mention anything about it. Just carry on the conversation, a normal one. We make sure we wrote home and told them that we're alive, but we couldn't tell them what our missions were, though.
There's a lot of material that's been written about the Doolittle Raid. There are movies that have been made. And one thing that I've always found interesting, was the timing of the whole thing. And it's somewhat similar to D-Day, where the timing they planned wasn't the timing that happened. And they ended up leaving early because they thought the Japanese had spotted them. Did you experience any of what was going on there when they actually took off? Did people find out? Did you see them taking off?
One of my guard duties at night was to man the 5-inch cannon and also look out the night and see if he saw anything. And then the pilots would come out and visit us. They can't smoke because of the a little teeny light would be seen. And also we were told that we were going to go within 600 miles of Japan, Tokyo. But at 800 miles, they spotted the sampans. And we knew the sampans had walkie-talkies or whatever you want to call it. So that's when they had to adjust their plan. So instead of taking off at 600 miles in Tokyo, they took off at around 800 miles of Tokyo. We're on what they call general quarters. And so in my case, I didn't get a chance to see them take off because my general quarters were different from my regular yard duty. So we didn't get to see them take off at all.
But I'm sure you heard about it.
Oh, yeah. We heard those big, I mean, they're a lot louder than a little F-16 or an SB bomber taking off by the...
You hear those two engines of the B-25 going, and you know something's happening. Do you remember, and maybe this wasn't the case, but were people speculating aboard ship on what might happen to these planes and whether they thought they'd make it where they were going? Did anyone have any idea what they were doing?
No one knew, and I don't think anybody expected them to be... anybody come back alive. Because, if you know, ground fire, did they have enough gas go all the way to where we didn't know where their destination was after they did their bombing. So
they didn't really know either.
No, that's right. That's right.
That's what makes that story so incredible, that these pilots and these crew members really did sign up for a suicide mission, not knowing where they'd be able to land, if they'd be treated well. And it's amazing that that they did as well as they did. When you've heard that story over the years, what's been the most impressive or inspiring aspect to you about all those planes and what they were able to do and the fact that so many of them did make it?
Well, it really, when we learned about it, you know, because they told us, the captain came over with a loudspeaker and told us all these things that happened. They didn't know, you know, 100%, but they told them that so far it's 75% good so far. Uh-huh. Now it's 80% good so far. And then they told us about a couple of them didn't, you know, I don't know how many went down, didn't make it, but I read the story, so we were very elated on the outcome.
So I imagine somewhere in that announcement on the loudspeaker, he said, those B-25s bombed Tokyo.
Yeah, they bombed Tokyo, and most of them made it out of there all right, and they're on their own. There was a few casualties, and, you know, made us feel real good that we had a part of it.
And the way history remembers that raid is not so much that the actual physical damage was a huge blow, but that the emotional power of what happened there was significant, not just to the Japanese, who now suddenly felt vulnerable, but to America to say, you know what, you hit Hawaii, well, we hit Tokyo. What did that feel like for you guys on the ship after having experienced Pearl Harbor, knowing what happened there, to hear some of our planes just bomb Tokyo?
Well, we felt real good about it because... Not the eye for eye or tooth for tooth business, but the idea that if you attacked us, you're going to pay for it one way or another. And this is a good example of how we were payback time.
So that's how Bob experienced it. You've probably heard a bit about the famous Doolittle raid on Tokyo, launched from the deck of the Hornet on April 18th, 1942. And, of course, America learned about it through the newspapers, on the radio, and from newsreels. So let's take a time machine back to 1942, if we can. You might have seen this newsreel from Castle Films, the headline, Yanks Bomb Tokyo, and the commentator, Basil Rysdale.
Packed on the after deck of the Hornet are 16 B-25 Mitchell bombers. Never before have these huge planes been launched from a carrier. Not until they are miles at sea do these men know definitely the mission for which they have volunteered. And now the signal is flashed for the takeoff, 10 hours ahead of schedule. Doolittle pilots the lead plane. There's a breathless moment as the big bomber gathers speed. It's airborne. The first Army bomber ever to be launched from a carrier is safely in the air. Now they know it can be done, and they time their takeoff with the upsurge of the bow of the carrier in the heavy sea. The defense system, as they practice it here, proved disorganized and panic-stricken when Doolittle and his men catch them flat-footed. Not a single shell fragment hit a plane. The loss of face by Tokyo may well have driven the Japs into the disastrous Midway expedition and its staggering losses of ships and men. Later, in China, the flyers who bailed out safely are decorated by Madame Chiang Kai-shek. The smiling Jimmy Doolittle does not yet know the fate of some of his comrades.
No, he didn't. He would learn later that 11 men were killed or captured by the Japanese, three of them executed in captivity. All of the aircraft, of course, were lost, but the emotional blow, the symbolism of that unexpected strike, carried great value for America and its allies. Doolittle, who once feared that he may be court-martialed as a failure, was awarded our nation's highest military decoration, the Medal of Honor. Bob Cole once posed for a photo with Jimmy Doolittle aboard the Hornet.
Sad part of it is I had a lot of pictures taken with the pilots. I had a picture taken with General Doolittle, and I lost them all when the ship went down.
You had that film in your locker.
I had a film in my locker, plus my $2, plus all my clothes.
Was there anything else that you want to say about Doolittle and that raid and what it means to you still today?
You know, I feel honored that I had a little tiny bit to do with that raid, just a tiny bit, because all the things should go toward Doolittle and their crew and how they, all the time they spent practicing how to go off an aircraft or someplace else. I think that was great for their part.
The thing that wasn't so great for you, they were gone and they had their own survival things to deal with, but what they did made your ship a target. The Japanese knew the aircraft carrier that had launched those planes, and that meant there was a bigger price tag on the Hornet's head than just about anybody else. Did you guys realize that at the time, that you were marked?
No, you know, it's quite an incident, because out there where we got sunk, we weren't the only aircraft carrier got sunk out there. My job during the battle is we were on the second floor in the forward mess hall. And what we did was put the bomb, the vanes and fuses on the bombs and send them up to the hangar deck or flight deck. In the forward mess hall, there were 35 of us down there in that mess hall, and we tripped up the elevator as fast as we could. And what happened, the bombers, Japanese bombers came off the island of Guadalcanal, which they own, and they just kept bombing us and bombing us. And we didn't have kamikazes hit us. You know, they hit right at the flight deck and hit where the motors and all that, the control tower is. And one of the bombs came right down the elevator where we were and exploded. And the shrapnel from the mess tables hit me right in the eye, right here. And they cut my eye down, lowered my eye down, so I lost my eye, my vision and everything else. And we lost the elevator, and out of that 35, only 12 of us came out alive. I don't know why. And then all of a sudden, we over the loudspeaker, it says, abandoned ship, abandoned ship. And I don't know where we're going to get up there.
We're going to find out how in just a moment. It's time for our final break, but we'll hear what Bob Cole had to do 80 years ago this week to survive the sinking of the USS Hornet. Head to hometownheroesradio.com for photos connected to today's episode and links to the complete original interviews with the voices you've heard from today. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest, did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma, because you can check out their Wall of Honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there, and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that Wall of Honor.
On honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special episode marking 80 years since the sinking of the USS Hornet. This Wednesday, October 26th, is that anniversary, 80 years since Bob Cole lost his eye, or at least the use of it, and very nearly lost his life. When we left off, we heard him describe putting fuses and vanes on bombs in the forward mess hall when a Japanese bomb came down the elevator and detonated, killing 23 of the 35 men in that room. Bob was stunned, hurt, blinded, but soon heard the order to abandon ship, and he had to try to find a way up and off of that crippled carrier.
So we crawled up the ladders to the hangar deck, and then we had to jump into the water, and I happened to find a towel to hold my eye up like this, because it was just laying down by the skin underneath here, and an optic nerve that held it from just going out altogether. And I had two big holes in my back from shrapnel. So we abandoned ship, and I stayed in the water for about 45 minutes to an hour before I was rescued, because, you know, all the people were abandoning. The destroyer, Mustang, came up and picked me up. Then they took me into the dressing room, and they sewed my eye up with no anesthetic, so I was in such a shock. From there, they took me to the French island called Noumea. Also, we had a hospital ship, Solace, S-O-L-A-C-E, and I was put aboard there, and that's when they were determined what to do with my eye. They weren't worried about my back, and my back hurt more than the eye. But 3 days on board the ship, hospital ship, there was a cargo ship going back to San Diego, so we drew straws who was going to go back. I happened to draw a good straw. There were some married couples there, married people wanted to go. I'll give you $5,000 for that. I said, well, I'll never see you again, buddy. I may be dumb, but I'm not stupid. So I went back to, but took us about, I think it was 2 weeks or so before we got to San Diego. And then we put in the San Diego Naval Hospital. And I stayed there for almost 8 months. My parents were given a letter saying I was a MIA, you know, missing in action. Because nobody knew where we were, you know, everything's in uproar.
Man, there's so many questions about this. I didn't want to interrupt you because it's so captivating, the story that you told. But I'm going to backtrack with you and kind of take you through some of those steps along the way. So at the time that you guys got hit, you were on that second deck putting fuses on bombs?
Yeah, putting a fuse and bomb and vanes on the bomb. And then we'd ship them up in the elevator to the hangar deck or flight deck, probably the hangar deck first, because they couldn't put the planes on the hangar deck up to the flight deck until the planes on the flight deck took off. And then
all of a sudden this explosion happens.
Bomb came right down the elevator, which we used to go up and down and ship the bombs, and they exploded. And happened to be in the forward mess hall. The tables are all aluminum or something like that, and they just scattered, and then shrapnel hit all of us.
So all of the explosive material and shrapnel within the bomb was added to by all this metal material inside the room. I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes and understand what that felt like, because, I mean, this is sudden and intense, I imagine. What did it feel like?
You know, I was in shock. Looking around and also seeing how, you know, we're told to abandon ship, find out where the ladder was, because, you know, I'm not normal. And then seeing some of my good friends dead, and find out where the other ones who were not dead, so we all could go up, you know, one at a time, the ladder. And it's, you know, it's chaos.
And your left eye is hanging out of the socket, just hanging on by a thread.
By the skin underneath and one optic nerve there.
You're wounded in the back.
When they took the shrapnel out of the holes in my back, whatever the utensils they use, they could see my rib. Yeah.
You had to be in a lot of pain.
Oh, well, when you're in shock, you don't know what I was in pain, very much so. Then I had to jump in the water.
Well, you had to get up to where you can jump in the water first. And
also I had to find a life jacket.
And you probably can't see very straight with only one eye.
That's right. blood just rolling all over the place. There, your camaraderie is great because people are helping each other. They grabbed me, you know, and led me to where I'm supposed to jump, and then we jumped together so I wouldn't go someplace else.
That's not a jump in a wading pool.
They say it's around between 40 and 60 feet. And thank God I wasn't on the flight deck. So that's higher up.
Yeah. Did you have to hold your eye in while you jumped?
I did because I had a towel. I found a towel when I was there, and or some guy might have found it for me. And I lift my eye back up and then hold the towel like that and held it all the time I was there. And they said, make sure when you do get in the water, make sure you float on your back because your back has more protection than your stomach does. Your stomach is just old fat.
And this may sound like a dumb question or a dumb series of questions. Were you scared? Did you think you were going to die?
Very scared. Very scared. You know, I've never been through anything like that. I'm a little farm boy. Never even had guns around our house or anything like that. So I don't think about, you talk about a life lesson. I probably learned more the 4 years I was in the Navy than I learned 4 years in college about life. I'm not talking about books now. I'm talking about life. I learned everything. I learned things I never even envisioned I'd ever know, you know, or have to do. But that's, I'm not the only one, you know.
The phrase trial by fire takes on new meaning when we hear a story like yours. So you've gotten out of the fire, out of this sinking ship, but now you're in the water. And there are all kinds of things to worry about in the water. How long were you in the water?
Anywhere from about 45 minutes to an hour.
How long did it feel like?
Eternity. But I looked around, I said, I'm not here by myself. That's the best part of it. If I had to be there by myself, I might have just turned over and said, the heck with it.
How many did you have with there? Do you remember any of them?
On our ship, because there's a lot of ships out there picking up people out of the water. I would say it was about 20 in my particular area.
Did you have anything to help you stay afloat?
Yeah, your life jacket, that's all. That's all. And, you know, you paddle, dog paddle or something like that.
And I want to get back to your story and how you recovered and all that, but how often over the years, how often do you think about those shipmates of yours who didn't make it?
At first, I didn't think too much about it because I was thinking about myself. In fact, after I came back and I went through college and I was teaching, they thought I had post-trauma, and they sent me to a psychiatrist and all that, even after when I was teaching. And, I feel sorry for those people, but life goes on, you know, and I met other people because after I got out of the hospital, I had another adventure. Because what they wanted to do was give me a medical discharge out of the hospital. And I said, no, I don't want one because I signed up for 4 years because I want a college education. And this is the only way I'm going to get it. So I don't want a discharge. So they put on my papers that I could never be shipped outside the continental limits of the United States. So I was put on recruiting duty. I was sent to St. Louis and recruiting aviation cadets. I never thought about teaching, you know, because I was a social studies major and a PE minor, and I was put in St. Louis. We live in private homes. I go out in Missouri, Kentucky, Indiana, recruiting at the high schools, just like that guy recruited me.
And this is while the war is still going on.
Oh, the war is still going on, yeah. And I recruited aviation cadets. So when the recruiting was closed up, I was sent to St. Olaf College in Northville, Minnesota. Anybody know about Northville? That's where Jesse James robbed the bank. Anyway, in this small town south of Minneapolis, there's two colleges. St. Olaf is for Navy cadets. On the other side of the river was the Carleton College for Army cadets. And so I was sent to St. Olaf, and that's where I taught English and math. I didn't know I wanted to be a teacher, but by recruiting and going to all these high schools and teaching there. And then when that closed up, I was sent to Miami, Florida, Opa-locka Air Station. It's quite a coincidence, talking about Miami, there was a hurricane coming in. So we had to take our papers with us and stay in a hotel until the hurricane was over. Then I stayed at Opa-locka Air Station. And when my 4 years was up, I said, it's time to go.
Well, that's impressive that college education meant that much to you, that they're giving you your discharge. You said, no, I want to serve some more. And I'm curious, when you're out there recruiting guys, the war is still going on. In fact, the war is getting worse and worse if you look at it from a casualty perspective. How often did you talk about what had happened to you?
Well, I gave them the whole story, like what happened to me. And I said that, but remember, my story is only one. And here's a chance for you to do what I meant to do. I want to go to college. Now here's a chance for you to go to get a free college education, learn to be a pilot, because if you do survive the war, most of the pilots go on to be pilots for United, you know, all the airlines.
So would you say you were a pretty good recruiter then?
Oh, I thought so, because we had a lot of McFingal.
So none of them ever said, hey, it almost killed you. Why do I want to go do that?
No, they didn't say that.
As far as the recovery, so, I mean, you get picked up. You know, maybe I didn't spend enough time on that. How great did that feel to get picked up out of that water?
I thought they were never coming. Look, well, there's, 3,000 people in the water. Count the other ships and all that people. How can they handle so many people? I thought, well, when I saw that ship coming towards us, we all hollered, hey, over here, over here. You know, you've seen that on TV, haven't you? Uh-huh. Hey, over here, I'm over here.
Best thing you ever saw?
Oh, man. Better than ice cream.
And you talked about being in shock when that bomb hit and you're hit in the back and your eyes hanging out. When did that shock wear off and when did you realize what had happened to you?
I think the shock wore off was when I was on board the hospital ship Solis. They had, more trained doctors. Because when you're on board, like that destroyer, and you're moving and you're the operator, you know, he's trying to do the best he can, but you're still under fire, and you're moving. And so when I was aboard the Solis, the hospital ship, you know, they're standing still. They're not moving. In fact, they wanted to take my eye out and give me a glass eye. Thank God that cargo ship came along. Because what am I going to say? But they know more medically than I do. And so I figured whatever they say is going to happen. So I was very fortunate that I still have my same eye, but little by little, I can distinguish day and night. And once in a while, I can see a hand, but if you put one or two or three, I would never see that. So
you see fine out of your right eye, but the left eye has never been the same since.
No, and the right eye that's why I go to the Veterans Hospital here every 4 months, and they give me, I put drops in my eye, and DMV wants 20/40, but the best I can get is 20/50. And the DMV say, that's good enough for me. Uh-huh. So far.
Well, I know you covered a lot of miles all those years of referee and basketball, and that I have to go there because it's too ripe for the picking. What is the biggest criticism about referees every year, that they need glasses or they can't see? Did you ever have some people heckle you about your basketball reffing?
I said, hey, I got both eyes, but I only see out of one. And then a lot of times they razz you, and then I might say, I'm laughing all the way to the bank.
If they only knew what that eye had been through, that it would be heaping coals on top of their heads, I'm sure.
Most of the coaches, you know, we might meet at the bar, and we have good times. And I remember one time when I met at the bar, and I put my glasses on, and this coach's wife says, why the hell didn't you put those glasses on while you're refereeing? I said, I might have seen too much, and it caused the game to go longer.
Yeah, we don't want that whistle blowing too much. So you said, was it 8 months in the hospital?
8 months. There's a comic side of that, too, you know, because I had both eyes covered all the time because they didn't want to have the strain on one eye. But if you wanted liberty whenever you're able, you had to do one or two things. You either polish all the brass in your area or go to the zoo and clean out the zoo pens. I said, well, I'm not going to the zoo. I've been in the zoo all my life. Out in that water, that's the zoo. So I didn't go much liberty. No, either that or I just polished the brass.
8 months is a long time, and your back's healing up, your eyes healing up. What was the hardest thing for you to deal with?
Well, I told you before this, you know, I never had a chance to call my mother to let her know where I am because I knew I was listed as MIA. When I was able to get to the phone, when they allowed me to use the phone, I called my mom and told her, she's in shock because she hadn't heard anything about it from me.
She thought you were dead.
Yeah. In fact, they had a funeral for me. That was before I called her. And I called her and she's, oh, God. Well, she had a sister living in Glendale. And so she immediately called her sister and her sister came down and visited me once a month. That was something. But, you know, it was lonely. You lay there and you can't see because your both eyes are covered. In fact, when I was going to college and my wife and I was all covered, and I had a biology class and I had to trace the blood from the start to the finish in your heart. and I couldn't read a book, so she would read it to me. You go from this vein to this ventricle, this ventricle, this artery. I pass it.
And that's what I'm wondering, because, I mean, I think it's obvious to everyone listening, it's pretty remarkable that you survived when so many did not that day. So in all this time where you're recovering, you got your eyes covered, you can't see anything, you're in a pretty helpless situation. Did you ever think that you would get married someday, that you'd have a daughter, that you'd have grandkids and great-grandkids?
Never even thought about it. All I thought about is getting healthy, get back on my feet, go to college. I really wanted to go to college. Because all my friends at Odo, you know, they came from pretty rich families. When I say rich, I mean they're better off than we were. And they're all going to college, and what am I going to do? There's no jobs in a town of 300 people. You got two gas stations, two grocery stores, a bank, the post office. That's it. I felt lonely, hoping someday to get back to normal.
And it was a good thing you went to college, not just because you had a great 30-year career as a teacher, but because that's where you met your wife.
I met my wife, and we were married 62 years before she died of dementia.
You want to tell us a story of how you met her over there?
We played cards at the Union. Neither one of us had much money. See, I was living off in the Navy, and we played cards, bridge, and then we'd go from there. We might go to the shop. We'd order a Coke and two straws. Get ice cream, we get two spoons. Yeah. So it's very, very, very wonderful woman.
And I'm curious, as your career in education went on, did you ever bring up your war experience? Did you ever share that with anybody?
No, never. Kept quiet. You know, to this day, I don't belong to the American Legion. I don't belong to VFW. I don't belong to the Purple Heart.
Why not?
I don't like to be around people, and all they're talking about is war stories. I have my own, and I get tired of hearing the same. I don't like to hear war stories. Yeah. That's why I don't join those groups. I've had opportunities after opportunities. Sure. I'm sure they would help me get better, more benefits than I get, but I'm satisfied. Like I tell my wife, and she says, what did you do with this? And I said, I don't want to talk about it.
And you keep your Purple Heart tucked away. Do you remember when they gave it to you? Was it a general that gave it to you, or how'd you get it?
I tell you how I got it. I didn't even know I had it. I was at the University of Iowa, and my mom called, and she says, guess what? I said, what? Some Navy people came to the house and they presented the Purple Heart to you. I didn't even know I had it. So when I went home that weekend, I got to see the Purple Heart.
What does that mean to you?
It means that they gave me some credit for the time I spent and the parts of my life I gave up. It means a lot to me. They say I should have other medals, and I said, well, I don't care about it. My main thing is my health.
So I know you can't do this. It doesn't look possible, but if you could go down to the bottom of the ocean and the wreckage of the Hornet, what would you try to get out of there? What went down with that ship that you wish you still had?
I like those pictures I had with Doolittle and the pictures I had with him, the pilots. Any souvenirs that I got when I was in Hawaii, there's not much I had. You know, being a rookie, a petty officer, you don't have many things.
Certainly nothing as powerful or as sobering as the memories he's carried now for 80 years. Memories that make him grateful and all of us grateful he survived. I trust your perspective might be just a little bit different than it was an hour ago. And perhaps you might want to learn a little bit more about the USS Hornet, a ship that participated in World War II for less than a year, but provided the tapestry for so many heroic moments to be etched into history. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. We dedicate this program to the 140 men who perished with the Hornet on October 26, 1942. Together, reminding us once again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.